One of the reasons that I really like meeting here at Pantages is because of this panoramic view that you get when you're up here. So whether I'm speaking or I'm leading music, I like to just kind of be able to look out and see here, which is sometimes why I forget words when I'm singing or just totally lose my place because I start thinking about other things. But anyway, I really like seeing, you know, sort of City Hall here, the concert hall over there. And I like to think about sort of the history that echoes off of this area of the city. If you've ever seen this image from the 1919 strike, that is right there, right? That's the old City Hall. That's the Union Bank building right there. I also like to think about this theater and the sort of vaudeville performers who came through here, paid their dues, and went on to become really big stars, actually, afterwards. Because this was a major sort of hub for vaudeville in the early 20th century. So when I'm up here, it's interesting because the most prominent building is that I see is that one, which is was called the Union Bank Building. You can look at it. whenever I'm up here, I think about it. And so I just want to talk about it a little bit to start off today. So any of you that know your Winnipeg architectural history, as I'm sure we all do, may already know that that building, that was the Union Bank building, is considered the first skyscraper in Western Canada. Now, I know it's a bit hard to believe that this 9-story building was once the tallest building in all of Western Canada, but it was. Because things were a lot shorter in 1904 when that was built. Now, the reason that it was considered a skyscraper has a little bit more to do with its construction than its size. It was one of the first steel construction buildings in Canada. So because it was built on a steel frame, it was able to go a lot higher than the other buildings that would have been built out of wood or stone alone. It remained a point of pride for Winnipeggers for a number of years, not just for its height, but also because of sort of its exterior design and the beauty of it. It has sort of this terracotta structures on the top and all the brickwork and all that. I won't go into too many details, but according to the Manitoba Historical Society, I'll quote, in the sophistication of its architecture, this headquarters building points to Winnipeg's central position in the rapidly expanding economy of early 20th century Canada. So yeah, that across the street, this building you probably have walked by, driven by, whatever, a million times, was once the most important building in all of Western Canada. And it's still historically significant for that reason. And it's funny because I remember when I first heard about this building, I think I was in junior high and on one of these sort of tours that they do around downtown. It was strange because since 1992, it was basically abandoned and just sat there empty. And it sat there for 18 years. And so I remember thinking about how strange it was that this building that was once so important is now was just rotting away. Since then, Red River College has bought it. It's got a restaurant on the main floor. They're doing great things. Red River College is really one of those real leaders in downtown preservation and historical buildings and all that. I'm not just here to talk about downtown revitalization, although I think that is a noble cause. What I really want to think about is the way in which big things become very small very quickly. So I'll give you a little more history. Within 5 years of that building being constructed, the Union Bank building was replaced as the tallest building by the Child's building. This is no longer there. This is Portage and Main, actually. They tore all that down. And then within a few years, that was replaced as the tallest building by the Hotel Fort Garry, which was replaced by the Legislative Building in 1920, which held the title for a long time, actually, until 1969, when the Richardson Building was built. And the Richardson Building is now the second tallest building to 201 Portage, which was the TD Building and a few other things, which was built in, I think, the early 90s, 92 or something like that, which is still the tallest building. But will be replaced, will move to the third tallest building, apparently by 2019. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but by two more buildings that are being, I don't think they've started building them yet, so it probably won't be 2019. Anyway, and of course, these are just the buildings that have held the title of tallest building. There's lots of other buildings that are taller than the Union Bank building, to the point where if you look at a skyline view. Where is it, right? I think it's somewhere in the corner here, but you can't see it, right? This once important building is now not even sort of visible in a picture. And of course, that's how cities work. It would not bode well for our city if the tallest building in 1904 were still the tallest building in 2017. That'd probably mean we stagnated a little bit. So it's fine. And the interesting thing is, so if you go downtown now and you walk around, that 201 Portage building is the tallest building you'll see. And if you're standing next to it, it does feel, you know, significantly larger. Here's a scale size. This is from a website called skyscraperpage.com, which I spend way too much time on, especially this week. But it's fascinating. It's just a great site. Anyway, you can do all of these. People put these in on their own, and yeah. So obviously, yeah, it's over twice as large. But then if you sort of open your gaze out a little bit, and we move beyond Winnipeg, you start to notice some different things, right? So the tallest building in Winnipeg right now, let's compare it to, say, one of the tallest buildings in Manhattan, the Empire State Building. It gets pretty small. The tallest building in the Western Hemisphere, CN Tower, and then the tallest building in the world. This is the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, right? So now the Union Bank Tower is not even as big as this, like, maintenance shed, probably, for the for the Burj Khalifa, right? And our Canway or 201 Portage, you know, would lose it compared to the other ones. So this has a way of shifting our perspectives, right? Suddenly these tall buildings don't seem so tall. But there's a funny thing that happens when you're around tall buildings. Now I've seen four of these five buildings in real life, and this funny thing happens when you look up at them, because they're so enormous that I found I couldn't even really contextualize what I was seeing. And so they inspire this sense of awe because of their scale, but I also found myself feeling, like, very quickly, they became banal because they actually did exist, right? So they're not impossible because they're standing right in front of you. And then if you spend any amount of time around structures like these, they quickly become pretty commonplace. As astounding as the CN Tower or the Empire State Building is when you first see them, if you spend a few days in Toronto or Manhattan or cities like Chicago, the buildings sort of become nothing more than markers to help you find your way, right? If you're in Toronto and you're not sure which way you're looking, just look for the CN Tower and you know, okay, that's south, this is north. Same thing with the Empire State Building. And so these giant structures that are supposed to inspire awe become, you know, place markers, basically. And I think that there's something very human about our ability to become accustomed to the extraordinary very quickly. You know, if we really think about it, we live in this incredible universe. We're on this one in a trillion planet, which grew life despite impossible odds. But yet, if you're like me, you hardly have time to sort of consider these things, since most of your brain power is expelled on annoying drivers or silly arguments, disappointing TV shows, calorie intake, the appropriate amount of screen time for a four-year-old, that unqualified coworker that keeps getting promoted, you know, fears that you're a disappointment to everyone you know, racist Facebook friends, the expiry date on that milk in the fridge, you know, bigger things, the KKK, nuclear war, Russia, fascism. Like, what year are we living in, seriously? And maybe you get a few minutes a day to consider the meaning of life. And then, of course, that existential terror that invariably follows that question of how could God let things like hurricanes and terrorists and you know, dangerously unqualified politicians happen, which always leads me, at least, to the worry that either God is not good, or maybe just not God. But anyway, we'll come back to God in a little while. First, I want to throw a few more numbers at you. Okay, I want to do this because I want to try and get a sense of scale. So let's go back to Winnipeg here. Winnipeg is 464.1 square kilometers. Manitoba is 647,797 square kilometers. Canada is 9.985 million square kilometers. The Earth is 510.1 million kilometers, square kilometers, sorry, the surface of the Earth. And the Earth's distance from the Sun, our closest star, is 149.6 million kilometers. And the diameter of our solar system is 287.46 billion kilometers. All right. So at this point, these numbers don't really mean anything anymore, right? They're sort of beyond comprehension, which is sort of the point. But nevertheless, I'm going to show you some more pictures because I want to think about this. So here we go. Here's the Earth. Sorry, this is kind of hard to see, but all right. Here's everything we know in this on this planet, right? And we back out a little bit. We get to our solar system. And Earth is here. We back out a little further. We get to our interstellar neighborhood. And we are, you can't even see. It's in there somewhere, right? That's the point. Then we back out a little further. We get to the Milky Way. There's a faint little point here. This is our interstellar neighborhood. Go a little further out. This is our local galactic group, right? So we are, our Milky Way is just one of these, you know, galaxies here. And then we back out a little further because our galaxy is part of a supercluster called the Virgo supercluster. And we're in there somewhere. Go a little further out. These are all our local superclusters, right? It's big. And we're, you know, in one of these little clusters is everything. And then we'll go out a little further. And this is the entire observable universe. And here's our Virgo supercluster, right here. So the point is, at the risk of understating, the universe is pretty big. And there's a few other, you know, just a couple other things to think about. I'm not going to talk about this one too much because Tim said he's going to be exploring this a little bit next week. But I want to think about the idea of time just for a second. So if we were to shrink down 4.6 billion years, which is what they estimate the age of the Earth, into 60 minutes, this is everything that's happened on Earth since it was formed. So you get, you know, your first fossil evidence, first bacteria, way over here, jellyfish, right? And then you have all the other animals coming in, and then you see first human ancestor came in at about a minute, just over a minute ago, and the first modern human about a tenth of a second. That's how long we've been here in the whole history, right? And so, you know, and some people believe that if we sort of keep going the way we are going, we might not be here much longer than that, which I find simultaneously depressing, but also sort of awe-inspiring that the entirety of human history could be nothing more than sort of an imperceptible blip in the history of the universe. So suffice to say, we're tiny. We're probably even less than tiny, to be realistic. But we're here, and we're sentient, and because of that, we feel the power of our own importance. And conversely, at the other end of the spectrum, is God. Somewhere, somehow, this thing that we call God is concurrently present within and without all of these things. Now, if you're like me and you have a difficult time conceptualizing and contextualizing large buildings to the point where I allow my brain to just reduce their significance to points and place markers so that I don't have to sort of acknowledge their magnitude, imagine how hard it is to conceptualize something that is so much larger than the largest thing we as a species have been able to quantify, namely the observable universe. Now, what I find so interesting about the phenomenon of religion is that it is, at its core, this paradoxical endeavor to both admire and destroy God. I'll unpack that a little bit. Arguably, interest in religion is born out of our desire to better understand the mysteries of life. This exploration tends to lead to admiration, which is manifest in the practice of worship, and an enthusiasm for the tenets of any particular religion. So let's think about Christianity in particular, since that's the one we're most familiar with. Our curiosity about what God might be like is expressed through the person and message of Christ. And in a traditional understanding, his sacrifice on the cross makes it possible for human beings to live in this relationship with God in this enigmatic thing that we call the kingdom of heaven, which is a huge idea that I'm not going to dig into today. And so the enthusiasm towards Christianity comes from the recognition and appreciation that of the grace inherent in the Christ story. Now, this is, of course, all lovely, but religion becomes problematic when institutions like churches or denominations try to contain the uncontainable with doctrines and dogmas designed to sort of anthropomorphize God. Do you guys know that word, anthropomorphize? Yeah, anyway, it means to sort of make something not human, to understand it in a human way. So we want to anthropomorphize God in order to create something that is quantifiable, predictable, appeasable, and most importantly, small. So we think back on the history of sort of human conceptions of God. If you've ever wondered why the Greek gods, if you've ever read about them at all, were such jerks, it's because the ancient Greeks needed a way to understand the random fortunes that were characterized their lives. So they imagined their higher powers as that they were moody, greedy, petty, and remarkably often really horny, so that they could understand, and through that, they could understand the universe better, because if it were run by beings that, although having supernatural powers, were no better than the corrupt leaders or annoying neighbors that they encountered every day. The ancient Hebrews, through a combination of revelation and community, came to understand God as a singular force, having domain over everything, and yet benevolent and interested in the lives of people, not just sort of in their worship and in their sacrifice. So the poets, the Hebrew poets, the thinkers, the prophets, they gave themselves the task of expressing this unknowable figure through art, through laws, through attempts at describing revelations. And there were prophecies and incredible stories that were compiled into what we now think of as the Old Testament. And the reality was, the people of God figured they had the guy pretty sorted out. And sorry, I'm using gendered pronouns for God. I apologize. It goes against everything I'm saying about how big God is, but languages can only go so far. So anyway, they figured they had God sorted out. He loved them, and if they obeyed his commandments, one day soon he would send a Messiah to lead them into victory over their enemies. Now, from the Christian perspective, that Messiah was Christ. And he came and fulfilled all the prophecies, but he did it differently than it was sort of expected. And so we see a major lesson in thinking we've got God all figured out, at least if we take the different perspectives. So, now in my younger years, I can remember being in Bible studies and then in Bible college and having conversations where we would sort of smugly laugh at how the religious leaders in the Bible were so blind to who Jesus was that he was fulfilling the prophecies right in front of them, but because of sort of arrogance or ideology, they just couldn't see it, like the Pharisees, for example. And we thought we were so much smarter now that we understand all those psychedelic writers and Daniel and Isaiah we're talking about. And then we would go on to read something like Revelation and make all sorts of these like really literal predictions about the end of the world. So we were doing the same thing. The reality for me was that I was afraid to think about the Bible as anything other than literal because of a fear that I would stumble upon some irrefutable evidence that something was factually inaccurate, and therefore I would no longer be able to trust the Bible as true. So I shunned science and became, you know, one of those guys who sort of wields pseudoscience and fantasy and sentimentality like a weapon to fight anyone that would tell me that, or that believe that the world was anything more than a few thousand years old, or those who had a tendency to sort of insinuate that the Bible is anything but a factual documentation of real events. Even all the stuff in the Bible that's contradicted by the stuff that comes later. For instance, the creation story. So I saw myself as a hero, as a tireless defender of God, but in reality, I was shrinking God and making God into my own image. I believe that since I wasn't brave enough to imagine God being bigger than the portrayal the Bible provides, he would get angry if I dared to think that way. I also was relying on what a lot of the pastors and other teachers I knew thought about the Bible, rather than sort of gaining an understanding of what it actually is, which forced the Bible to become my God, rather than something that points to something way bigger than myself. Or sorry, bigger than itself. And so for me, God had to be small, definable, simple, and tameable for me to believe in him. My faith, such as it was contingent on well-defined operating procedures, questions and answers, prayers and signs, essentially a litany of voodoo practices that would ensure that my being on my best behavior meant that God will give me what I want. Now, unfortunately for 17 or 18-year-old Tim way back there, God cursed or blessed me with the sort of obsessive brain that refuses to stop asking questions. I think Atticus might have gotten the same thing, because I'm starting to understand why when I was a kid on long car rides, my parents would have, let's see who can be quiet the longest contest. So it's a lot of questions coming out of that kid. Anyway, it's great. So I kept digging through a few Bible schools that I went to and university, and I came to understand things like ancient Near Eastern cultures and the sorts of narratives, devices that they use, the troubles of translation, the politics of religion, specifically when it came to putting the Bible together, the problem of pain, injustice, and discrimination, especially when it's inflicted on those who deserve it the least. And eventually I made it back to that old boogeyman called science. And I started reading, and I became entranced by the wonders of the universe, the incredible things that are going on around us inside, you know, all the time at the sort of subatomic level, right up to the unfathomable occurrences that are taking place every day in the farthest reaches of the universe. And along the way, I discovered that my resistance to science, which was really a resistance to truth, was the greatest hindrance to my faith and my appreciation of whatever God is. Because the more science revealed to me, the larger God became. And I know that runs counter to a lot of sort of Christian thinking in the popular culture. But the more science reveals, the larger God becomes. You know, I think about something like the theory of evolution, and I think it's this beautiful testament to the nature of God. It tells us so much about God's spirit of collaboration and his immense patience that he would wait all of this time as life slowly blossomed into something that could recognize his revelation and begin to live in community with the mystery of God. And so whenever I do sort of encounter occasionally biblical literalists or young earth creationists, I always try and be civil and recognize that we're all on a journey. But I'm pretty unashamed to say that I see sort of these small ideas about God as offensive in their willingness to be so limiting. The sort of hubris it takes to think that we as humans, with our tiny primate brains, can have something that created everything, all figured out, and easily explained, is what I think causes the divisions and the hate and the war and all those things that are contrary to Christ's message. And hubris, the idea that we know as much, if not more, than God, is the biggest obstacle to any sort of connection with God. Because nothing cuts off the desire for further exploration like thinking that you know everything. Instead, I think we should recognize our insignificance, our smallness, our vulnerability, and use that understanding to recognize that God reveals himself in myriad ways to us, to and through nature, science, art, and other people. And that no one has the corner on God or truth. And so we need to learn from each other while we drift through this incomprehensibly large universe. So, as a way to think about our place in the universe, I want to show you one more thing. Oh man, you can't see this at all. Okay. This is a picture called Pale Blue Dot. So what you're looking at here in the circled area and this little dot is Earth. This photo was taken from the Voyager 1 space probe, which incidentally celebrated the 40th anniversary of its launch just this past Tuesday on September 5th. So it was launched in 1977, and it took this picture on February 14th, 1990, when Voyager was 6 billion kilometers from Earth. The photo was taken at the request of the astronomer and author Carl Sagan. He wanted to sort of get a perspective. I wish you could see this better, because it's really an amazing picture. Go home and look up Pale Blue Dot, or look it up on your phones now. I won't be offended. it's really amazing. And so he delivered a speech regarding this in 1994 at Cornell University. And so I'm going to end today. I'm just going to read a bit of that speech, because I think it's really a beautiful way to think about our position, you know, as we go from where we are out to the universe, and to think about everyone else who's in the same position. So here we go. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you've ever heard of, every human being who ever lived out their lives. The aggregate of all of our joys and sufferings, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines. Every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilizations, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every hopeful child, every mother and father, every inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and every sinner in history, in the history of our species, lived there, on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary master of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of the dot on scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner of the dot. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we may have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. To my mind, there is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly and compassionate with one another and to preserve and cherish that pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Thanks a lot, everybody.